Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, friends.
There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and tell you why.
Good evening, friends.
We
I want to
feed them on the land.
I want to talk to you this evening about some of the important news that's going on. Tonight's show is going to focus on the Arab Spring 1 year on. First, I want to thank you for joining us. I'm your host, News Director Richard Spisak. I want to thank you on behalf of myself and my co-producer, Ms. Mickey Royce. And I don't want to waste too much time because we've got so much to talk about tonight. I do want to play this little excerpt of Elizabeth Warren's appearance on The Daily Show.
You know, we did a little bit earlier on in the show about this tax issue with Mitt Romney. This is the thing that is so frustrating to me. Mitt Romney says, look, I'm legally required to pay this amount. I don't pay a dollar more. It is what it is. Hey, if you change the system. They tried. That's the part he doesn't include. They tried to change the system. They tried to repeal that carried interest is only taxed at 15%. He and the other private equity funds fought it tooth and nail.
Yep.
Why is that? How are they allowed to make that happen?
You know, it's a big and it's a systemic problem here. I grew up in an America that was still investing in the middle class. That was the principal function of Washington and how it spent money. It said, we're going to invest in America's middle class. Got kids like me, the daughter of some, you know, guy who sold fencing, ended up...
We didn't know his name?
As a professor. But what happened is that we changed from that world.
Are you saying we don't invest anymore? Has the government abdicated that responsibility? Do we not have the money to do it? Do we not think that's a priority? What is your
No, what's happened is that Washington now works for those who can hire an army of lobbyists and an army of lawyers. You know, if you're in the drug business and you are selling prescriptions to seniors and you don't want to have to negotiate over the prices, Washington works beautifully for you. If you want subsidies to drill for oil, Washington is working for you. If you run a hedge fund and want to pay the lowest possible taxes, Washington is working for you. In fact, there was recently a study, just in the last couple of weeks, there was a study in which it comes out that 30 of the largest companies in the United States are now spending more on lobbying than they pay in federal taxes. Think about that. I mean, that is the investment, and that's what they see as the future.
But the thing that is, but they are the ones writing the complex tax codes. So, but they would pretend, see, this is so onerous for us, we have to hire all these people. They hire those people to make it onerous so they can worm their way through. Yes.
That's exactly right. But here's the other part to the story. Mm-hmm. Who really pays for that? And the answer is America's middle class. They're the ones who are left to pick up all the pieces, to pay the taxes, to keep the country running. And more to the point.
I just wanted to play you that little excerpt because it's so important that we keep our eye on the prize. There are a few progressive politicians. There are a few people who are looking to create the kind of leadership that America needs. And Elizabeth Warren is one of those people, and we have to make sure that we support people like her and people like a few of the progressive Democrats that we have here in Florida, Mark Pafford, who's going to be joining us next week, and also Jeff Clemons, who will be joining us next week. These are the kind of progressive leaders that we need to pick up the slack, to take responsibility, to be the kind of civil servants that you and I need. So we need to support those people. Okay, without any further ado, I want to go right into this. We've got several really intriguing people talking about issues in the Middle East, the Arab Spring 1 year on. First, I'm going to bring you Dennis Campbell, who's an author who's written a book called Egypt Unshackled. He had been monitoring the Tahrir Square Twitter feeds, and he has some really interesting insights. So without any further ado, Dennis Campbell, author and publisher. Here we go, Dennis Campbell, Egypt Unshackled. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Dennis Campbell, editor of the UK Progressive Magazine and author of the book Egypt Unshackled. Welcome, Dennis.
Hello.
Well, listen, you're talking to us from Cardiff, Wales. Why don't you tell us a little bit how you got interested in progressive matters, and especially how you got interested in the Arab Spring?
Well, I started as a progressive growing up in the great Commonwealth of Massachusetts, not to be considered a state. We had a system back when I was going to high school where you could not only become a member of your local school's student council, but there was a statewide student council where kids from 300 and some odd towns and cities across the Commonwealth came together to form sort of a mini student government. And that really caught my eye, and I became very involved and was one of the very first groups of students to go through the Washington, D.C. close-up program. And this was back in 1973 when we had the Watergate trial going on. And it was really quite interesting to be so totally immersed for 7 days as you are in that close-up program. And we actually got to meet then President Richard Nixon, who looked terrible at the time. He would resign the next year, but he was undergoing just a tremendous amount of pressure. And it was very interesting because it was such a very different time in our government. You had real giants. You had people that at least made a show of attempting to find some common ground and get things done, not the obstructionism that you see out there today. And I got bit by the bug, as they say, and it's been with me ever since. I've been writing about politics. I was one of those dreaded L-word people, a lobbyist for a while in D.C., worked for many years in the business world with Pricewaterhouse, now PricewaterhouseCoopers. So it was a very broad career, and decided a few years back that I'd been contributing articles to a number of magazines, mostly features, and decided I really wanted to devote more time to writing and reporting. And this happened in advance of a young senator from the state of Illinois deciding he was going to run for president. So having covered campaigns in the past, this was actually probably one of the most exciting campaigns, the one of 4 years ago, actually 5 years ago now. The UK Progressive Magazine was born during that time. We've now grown to some 20 or so contributors from all around the globe on a variety of topics, and I feel very, very blessed that there are so many people out there that want to contribute to the magazine and are outstanding writers. And we have a broad array of topics that we cover, mostly in the area of progressive politics, business, do a little bit of media. I became very interested in what was going on with the Arab Spring, to answer the other part of your question, with the Egyptian Revolution. I'm a bit of a techno bug. I really like new technologies. I was an early adapter to Twitter, an early adapter to Facebook, and I began to see some of their potential not just as business tools, but as organizing tools, as communications tools, and really began to follow all sorts of events. I can remember when the Turkish Airlines aircraft crashed just outside of Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam. Twitter was the one that broke the news, and obviously you could see an airplane on the ground. And they beat the BBC, they beat CNN, they beat all of the major networks by about 15 to 20 minutes because they had a protocol they had to follow, and that protocol did not include social media. Well, I became more interested in how social media could begin to break stories, but also, as a journalist, very concerned about making certain that you've got your facts straight, because as we saw with the death of Joe Paterno recently, the state press there at Penn State jumped the gun on Joe's passing and actually ended up with a black eye. As the Egyptian Revolution unfolded, I sit here in kind of a launch control. I've got two very large monitors that cover the desktop as well as television screens and tickers, and things are running and information is coming in all the time. And one of the most prized possessions is my tweet deck. And on that, depending on when a story breaks or I get news or information, I can then plug in that keyword, first of all, to see what's happening with that story on Twitter, then go to other sources as needed, and those 10 columns can go all the way across the entire screen, as well as live news feeds from news organizations that I don't think you can get that readily or easily in the United States, like Al Jazeera, for example. And what I found happening was, as the Egyptian story broke, most of us looked at that on the 25th of January last year and said, well, okay, Tunisia had just fallen 10 days earlier. We knew there were going to be more demonstrations happening. So it looks like Egypt has next. And it was a big demonstration, and not much was happening on that first day, just a lot of people. And a lot of the protesters were behaving in much the same way as the folks of the Occupy movement. You know, where's the media? All these people are gathered together. It's a big story. But it really wasn't a big story from the perspective of people who were in the journalism field. What happened the next 2 days, when the police then fought back and chased everybody down every side street and began to beat the living crap out of them, people disappeared, that's what made it a story. And as you began to look at what happened with Occupy, it wasn't a story until the NYPD cop, Joey Baloney, sprayed those two young ladies, and then 700 people were arrested atop the Brooklyn Bridge. That was what made it a story in the eyes of the media. And from then on, it was game on. When we got to the fourth day of the Egyptian Revolution and we saw what was happening, and we saw the battle for the bridge, and we saw what happened atop that bridge, where Muslim men were kneeling in prayer and the Egyptian police were spraying them on their prostrate backs with water cannons, the rage of the crowd was something that I don't even think the police themselves expected, and that was the day that fear died. And from then on, it was just 14 days from there right to the finish that literally were filled with take-your-breath-away action. And I live tweetcast every day. I would come in here into the office at about 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning, which was about 10 o'clock in the morning in Cairo, and I would look and see what had happened and start to compile blog feeds and information and Twitter feeds, and began to just basically aggregate all of the news that was coming in from those feeds. And I went from about 2,000 followers to about 7,000 followers in those 2 weeks, because people began to realize I had Al Jazeera. Most people in the U.S. didn't. And I was also following blogs such as The Guardian, Endearing America, several others, and was able to literally take, as statements were being made, the actual feed and say, this is what's happening from the government's perspective. This is what this journalist is saying. This is what this group is saying. And it began to form sort of a coherent mosaic. When it was all done at the end of the 18 days, my wife said, well, what are you going to do with it now? And, you know, as a typical journalist, I sort of looked at it and said, well, the story's over. And she said, well, you put all that time and effort into it. Why don't you do something with it? And I thought about it for a second. I said, well, we had about 3,000 tweets that I'd put together at that point in time. I said, but, you know, my tweets probably were not going to tell the story well enough. And back when we were putting this book together, Google and Twitter still had a relationship with a service called Realtime. And you could take that real-time service and plug in any keyword, and that keyword would then give you all of the tweets around that particular hashtag.
Oh my goodness.
So we started with Jan25, which was the major one. And my wife is a forensic accountant, so she knows how to build, and she loves doing that type of deep investigative work. And so she began to build a timeline off of Jan25, Egypt, Tahrir Square, which was the main focal point of the revolution. And then what I was looking at was some of the people who kept coming back over and over again as key voices there on the ground in Tahrir Square. So I gave her a list of about 10 people, and I've got to know some of those people over the course of the 18 days. So Mahmoud Salem, better known as the Sand Monkey, quite a character. He calls himself a minor celebrity, but his tweets were solid gold because, I mean, he had this impish sort of sense of humor that you just absolutely love. Okay, let's go play with the police. and he just had this, and the wit of the people of Egypt during those 18 days, and even still, there's a just an irony even beyond sarcasm, just a pure irony in their words that comes through in their tweets so brilliantly. And they also really had a commitment to getting the story right. So the minute I saw something that looked like it was a rumor, and there were so many times during the course of the 18 days where someone said, Mubarak has just left Egypt. And you would immediately see five or six of these key players say, no, he hasn't. Get your sources right. Stop making things up. And so they began to become this giant self-policing organism right there in the square. And it was just absolutely fascinating to watch the story build and unfold. And after we had this timeline with all of these tweets, we ended up with about 7,000 tweets when all was said and done, just under 7,000.
Wow.
And we began to then cull through them, and we realized if you followed them moment by moment, they made absolutely no sense whatsoever. It was just reading gobbledygook. So we then took it apart and said, okay, well, who are groups of people? And we began to look at, and we looked at mind maps, and we actually mapped out what the arc of the story was on that particular day. So we had the tweet database in binders, we had the mind maps to sort of say, here's what happened during the course of the day. And then I went back into the timeline, and it wasn't necessarily sequential, but you knew that this group of people were in the square, or this was a group of journalists, or this was the U.S. State Department and other officials, this was the European government, this was happening in Suez, this was happening in Ismailia, and you were able to put them together in such a way that it crafted over the course of that day what the highs and lows of the story were. And as I put it together, I would then look at that and say, okay, now what's the frame of reference needed? What's the cohesive binding material necessary to tie it together so that it wove a story? And by the time we got to it, we had this rip-roaring ride that followed every element of any screenplay you'd ever want to see. I mean, you had the reluctant hero in Wa'il Ghanim who, you know, didn't want to be and suddenly was thrust into the role. And when he was released from prison, 8 million people marched the next day, and Mubarak resigned the day after. You had the archetypal villain in Mubarak and the secret police who came into the square one day on horseback and camel, whipping and beating people. You had rocks falling like deadly snowflakes. You had a triage hospital in the Antiquities Museum. I mean, you had all these elements right there. And that's, I think, what makes the whole story so compelling, is you realize this was a fairly ragtag group of people, not unlike the Minutemen during the Revolutionary War, that came and did something that was not only improbable, you would say it was impossible. You're going to overthrow the second largest army in the Arab world, the Egyptian army, and you're going to force the leader of that country in just 18 days to resign from power. So it was fascinating. And when I saw that, I began to see that this was nothing more than a series of dominoes. It wasn't long after that you had Libya and Syria. You had things happening in Jordan, but their government decided to work with the people. Saudi Arabia bought everybody off, and you began to hear rumblings of noises even further to the north in Persia, in Iraq. And it's something that's still going to continue to go. And then suddenly, you had the Occupy movement. And the one thread that tied everything together was this enormous economic disparity. Yes, you had the hated figure of Mubarak, you have the hated figure of Gaddafi, you have the hated ruling figures of Ben Ali and Ahmadinejad and others, but you also had a ruling class, the 1% that controlled everything, and you had the vast majority of the 99% that were living on $2 a day. Now, it's a little bit better in the United States, but the same philosophy was there, the haves and the have-nots.
That's the conclusion of the first part of our Dennis Campbell interview. We'll be continuing in just a few minutes. I've got another one of our guests who's going to be joining us in a fuller capacity later. Emine, welcome.
Hi, Richard.
How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
Good, good. I was wondering, your personal experience, were you able to track the ongoing adventures in Tahrir Square, if one could put it so glibly? Were you involved in talking to people who were there on the scene?
Well, I didn't speak with anybody on the scene, but I was definitely following what was going on, especially after what happened to journalist Mona Atahawi, where they detained her and broke both of her arms. And recently, I don't know if you realize, there is a regrouping and another uprising, second leg of the revolution that she called on TV on CNN. And I believe people are not very happy right now what's going on in Egypt. And I listened to Jimmy Carter, our former president, on CNN too, that he was meeting with the Egypt's military rulers, the Field Marshal Mohammed Hussein Tantawi, and he doesn't believe, a president doesn't believe that they will submit to the authority of the civilian democracy very soon. So
Too bad.
I'm actually expecting another revolution, and it's what I think the second part of the election process ended on January 23rd, and it was very tiring, not a lot of people voted for that one. Mm-hmm. And but I'm definitely expecting another leg on the revolution, because if the Muslim Brotherhood and military still decides to dominate the government, mm-hmm. People in Egypt are gonna uprise again.
Well, thank you for that important insight. Let me go back for now to get the second part of Dennis's piece. Thank you so much for that insight. Thanks, Emine. Okay, here we go with our second portion of Dennis Campbell's speech. Let me ask you a couple questions.
Sure.
Obviously, this is just a tremendous story. You had what I would have to call a mind-blowing gold mine of research elements and data. But I was wondering, from your analysis, from people you've talked to, from looking at the read, I was wondering, there's a couple threads that different people have pointed out as either contributing factors or auxiliary motions that have augmented, supported, underlined it. There's conspiracy theories that say that without the WikiLeaks release of this, the exorbitant lifestyles, the duplicitous behavior of some of these political authority figures, without hearing about that corruption, that was a key critical factor in this. Others point to whether it be the hidden hand of the CIA or, conversely, the hidden hand of the Saudis. There are conspiracy theories in all of this. Did you choose to not look at that part and really just look focused at the data at hand, or what have you heard about those things? What credence do you give to this or that? Where do you fall in that, really kind of primarily an Occupy-related economic injustice and human rights thing versus some of these underlying pressure groups?
Well, you have a whole rash of conspiracy theorists out there, and as I began to put the book together, I began to realize that the only way it was going to work as a book was to focus on the 18 days.
Yeah.
Democracy is messy.
Yeah.
It's a 230-something year experiment in the United States and a bit longer over here, and it is still an experiment. I mean, even if you would have dropped somebody in who'd never, ever looked at the U.S. government and never understood, they would, have a reaction very similar to Castro to what's going on in this GOP primary. what are these idiots doing? But that is a part of and a function of building a democracy and a democratic state. It's not a straight line. It never is. There are highs and lows, and I often talk about pendulums and how they swing back and forth. Sometimes they speed up, sometimes they slow down. Well, if you look at Egypt as a whole, one of the things I ran into as I began to interview people who were there was a series of very conspiratorial whispers that would happen. I would have this this individual who, for example, might be a Coptic Christian. Now, keep in mind that the Christians and the Muslims were side by side in the square. There were some iconic photographs of Coptic Christians linking their arms, just encircle and protect Muslim men kneeling and prostrating themselves on the ground from possible attack. And there's iconic photos of people pretty much, you know, standing side by side and fighting together. One of the interesting things that happened, Rick, was that we had a number of people who would whisper very conspiratorially as I began to put the book together. And the spirit of what you saw with the actual revolution itself, the 18 days, the coming together, began to disintegrate almost immediately after Mubarak resigned, because you had groups that were much better organized, such as the Muslim Brotherhood. Even though they'd been illegal, banned, and were living underground for 83 years, they were fairly well organized as a political unit, whereas the young pro-democracy fighters were very much in an organic sort of structure. And even though everybody stood side by side, you had the Coptic Christians protecting the Muslim men kneeling in daily prayer, encircling them, protecting them from attack, and you had Muslims protecting Christians as they prayed on the Sundays that they were there in their ceremonies, and Muslims and Christians together side by side, you had the seeds already planted for the end result that we now have with a parliament that is mostly made up of the very moderate, but still it is the Muslim Brotherhood. And I think what people didn't understand was that there's a significant difference between being essentially an anarchist, being essentially someone who has fought for freedom, and actually being in a position now of changing and governing. And when I would do the interviews, I would hear people that would start to whisper, well, you really don't know what's going on. Here's what's happening. And they would speak very conspiratorially about one party or another. And I realized that that was more a part of the sausage making of a new government. And that wasn't really going to be terribly helpful for telling the story of the 18 days. And I knew that the further I strayed from the 18 days, the more trouble I was going to find myself in. And that doesn't mean I was naive. That doesn't mean I don't, in the book, call to task some of the past imperialistic moves by our State Department, by the United Kingdom's foreign ministry, by others in the region. That doesn't mean I don't call out and mention the WikiLeaks releases of certain documents at certain times, but I also don't focus on them and ascribe to any one particular conspiracy theory or the other. There are as many conspiracy theories as there are people. I mean, the one going around now that just totally blew my socks off has to do with this deployment of an old U.S. aircraft carrier in the Straits of Hormuz, and that it'll be a, you know, an incident to justify war with Iran. I went, oh, come on, guys. I mean, the false flag narrative that's going around. You could have conspiracy theories on any one of a number of topics, and I just say, look, there's enough material to mine just staying with the story and staying with what's actually happening and trying to figure out what the role of the military is going to be going forward, what the role of some of the more extreme parties are going to be, et cetera, et cetera.
Let me ask you this. Focusing in on the 18 days, the first batch of tweets that you got to this topic, what were the reports? The official story, I guess, insofar as official stories happen, is we had the man in Tunisia who did the self-immolation. That was a key moment. Was there a comparable moment in Egypt, or not from what you've seen in your data?
Well, you're speaking of Muhammad Bouazizi, and Bouazizi was a fruit vendor in Tunisia, and he had basically purchased his day's allotment of fruit and was about to go and sell it when he was harassed by a police officer who happened to be a woman, and she insulted him, his family, and took his cart away, she and his partner. He then had to go to the government office to then pay a fine and get his cart back. And it was in the mid-afternoon, and he wasn't getting anywhere, and he got so frustrated that he walked out in front of this government building and self-immolated. And that moment was when things began to really change inside of Tunisia. Tunisia had about 10 days of violence that led to the overthrow, and actually Ben Ali left the country for Saudi Arabia. He then had a stroke, but people began to realize, wow, if there's focused, organized revolt, something can happen. Now, this happened back in the beginning part of the month of January of 2011. The Egyptian pro-democracy movement was made up of people who called themselves the April 6th movement, as well as those who were protesting the death of another young person the year before. His name was Khaled Said, and he was beaten to death in an internet cafe in Alexandria, Egypt, because he had videotaped a corrupt police officer making a payment and uploaded it to YouTube, and the police killed him. Of course, they tried to say he swallowed a packet of marijuana, and that's why he died. But
oh,
he looked
clearly a death-defying act. Yeah.
Oh, if you look at the post-mortem photo that his brother took compared to the photo of what he looked like when he was alive, this went up on a Facebook page, and that's why this is often referred to as the Facebook revolution. Under emergency rule, which had been in place since 1981 when Sadat was assassinated, you could not gather in a group of more than three people or else you risked arrest. The one place they could not control was the internet. There was no way for them, and they hadn't really thought much about it. So it forced these movements, the April 6th movement, the Khaled Said movement, and others underground, and they began to show up on these Facebook tribute pages. Bouazizi from Tunisia had a Facebook tribute page. And what happened was hundreds of thousands of people would come to these pages, would like it, and then they would meet like-minded individuals and start communicating. This is what actually launched the revolution, was that they were able to then say, okay, now that Tunisia has fallen, we've got Twitter, we've got Facebook, we can communicate. They were pretty much very aggravated. They were pissed off that Tunisia had beaten them to the punch because they felt a much stronger beef and been doing this for a much longer period of time, yet Tunisia was the first one to fight for its freedom. So they chose the date of January 25th, and that's a fairly historical date in the history of Egypt. Back in 1950, the British governors came in to keep control of the Suez Canal. They came into a police station in the village of Ismailia, and they ordered the police there to lay down their arms. The police refused, and in the ensuing battle, 50 policemen lost their lives on the 25th of January. In 2009, Hosni Mubarak declared that a national holiday, a national day of remembrance, honoring the police. So what better day?
Very good.
In the eyes of these young pro-democracy protesters who started 10 years ago when they were in university, now they're in their early 30s, to really organize around something. It's a day designed to cause maximum embarrassment to both Mubarak and the police state he had created. So you had all of these elements coming together in a perfect storm. And then, as I say in the book, if you follow the tweets, it becomes very clear on that first day, it was a very elaborate game of cat and mouse. Somebody would tweet, the demonstration is now moving to such and such square on such and such street. The police were monitoring it and they would deploy there only to find that no, all the protesters had kind of, it was literally like a Keystone Cops film. They literally snuck around behind them and took another plank. And as the day went on, as we got to 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon on that first day, it became very clear that Tahrir Square was their main objective right from the very start. But they had to take all of these circuitous routes with multiple demonstrations, and they moved in as police went off to fight in one area. People kind of snuck around, and they all ended up in Tahrir Square. The police had...
I'm going to stop Mr. Campbell right there, because I do also want to get to Tufik, and I'm going to have two guests with me live on the show. So let me bring Tufik Zakaria, who is a councilman in Dade County and also has quite an extensive Middle East background. Before I do that, Emine, any quick comments on the second part of Mr. Campbell's speech?
No, actually, I was really enjoying the entire interview. It's just brilliant. I was so impressed by the January 25th date. And no, it's just a lot of good information. I was enjoying it.
Yeah, when we started talking, he ended up doing an entire hour. And so I'm going to have to play this over a couple evenings. Let me go ahead and bring on Tufik then. Thanks a lot, Emine.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Tufik Zakaria, who is a public administration graduate, also currently a city councilman. Tufik, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Ray, for the opportunity.
Now, Tufik, I've known you for many years as an activist on a variety of fronts. Why don't you tell us a bit about yourself and how you got interested in these matters?
Became interested in civil liberties and other economic issues and social issues as a result of 9/11, when President Bush created the Patriot Act, and I became concerned about the infringement of civil liberties in our country. Joined a group, and that's how I met you at Coral Gables Congregational Church, and became more involved, more active. Attended protests, attended forums, created forums at churches and universities, hosted speakers, and did some lobbying in our in Congress, citizenry lobbying, not one of the big major lobbying groups. And I've been involved ever since, and currently I'm a councilman here in Miami-Dade County. We primarily do vote on land zoning issues, and which not very related to civil liberties, but it's an issue that's also dear to me because land zoning has everything related to environmental, to the growth, to the expansion of cities, expansion of the county, and if we don't control it and maintain it properly, it could create disastrous effects in the near future. And I guess you're aware of how Miami-Dade has grown the past 30 years as a former resident.
Yeah, I moved to Miami in 1967, so I've seen some changes.
You've seen some major changes. And so, that's about it right now. I mean, I've been there since November, and hopefully I'll get reelected in November of this year.
Well, let me ask you this. I know you have your heritage is Lebanese English. What are you hearing from your Mideast sources now? Do you still have family?
Beirut. I have my cousins and uncle and aunt living there. Fortunately, I mean, they're doing pretty well because of their economic standards of living.
That's great.
They're just the family, but that doesn't reflect the entire Lebanese population.
Of course.
The country right now is somewhat in a quagmire. There's been a lot of civil unrest. There's been, every week there's electricity cuts in Beirut and surrounding areas. And there's an issue of cost and people not paying and infrastructure cost and it cost of importing fuel to the country, as well as the political situation where they're fighting over seats and they're fighting over political power that's not really pertinent to a majority of the people's concerns.
Now, as I understand it, Lebanon has a parliament?
Lebanon has a parliament. They have a prime minister, which is a Sunni Muslim. The president is Maronite, which is Eastern Catholic, and then the parliament speaker is Shiite Muslim. And everyone has their own powers of how to legislate and how to distribute power among their sects and among their religious sects. And there's, since the Arab Spring started, there's been a small resurrection of activists who are calling for the elimination of the sectarian system, which means that it gives quotas to Christians, it gives smoke quotas to Muslims and different sects within both religions. And the reason being, it hasn't really benefited a lot of people. It's benefited the clans, it's benefited the families, the power, but it hasn't created a improvement in the political or economic situation for the past 50 years. More than that, 60 years, I believe, Lebanon became a parliamentary democracy in 1943. And ever since then, it's been kind of like a civil quagmire. There's always a new prime minister, there's always a new president, and there's always civil and military unrest. And so currently right now, fortunately, there's nothing really major going on except there's been protests against electricity cuts that's been going on for 10, 15 years. There's been people just dismayed about what the situation is. And the people who are happy are the people who are making money.
Yeah, that's every country has its one percenters, right?
every country has their one percenters. That is correct. And a lot of young graduates like myself who went to university there, who went to American University of Beirut or Lebanese American University, they either leave to the Gulf to find better job opportunities, or they go to Europe, or they come here to America.
Let me ask you this. Speak to the areas that you've heard the most, should we say, ground truth about. Lebanon has some very, very interesting neighbors. Israel, Syria. What do you hear from some of these neighboring states? Do you hear border issues from folks you know? Or what have you heard about the Arab Spring and its reactions and its, should we say, boil out?
Well, as a result of what happened, what's happening in Syria, there's been, allegedly, probably believe it, that there's been people who's been smuggling arms into Syria to fight the Syrian government. Then, on top of this, historically, Syria was controlling Lebanon for 20-something years, and so there's always a lot of people in Lebanon that did not like the Syrian control of Lebanon. The irony of it is that the patriarch of the Maronite Church, who was fiercely anti-Syrian and actually is in support of the Assad regime because they protect Syrian Christians, the Assad regime protects the Syrian Christians. So the people who were against the Syrian regime in Lebanon, with occupying Lebanon, are now for it because they are against the so-called Islamic caliphate that might be created in Syria. And then on top of that, Syria does not recognize Lebanon formally. They don't have an embassy in Beirut. And but the relations among governments is they're favorable to each other. Sometimes they're neutral, but it's also depending on the people who's in power.
I would think that with so much instability in Syria, that there'd be a lot of refugees heading to both Lebanon and Jordan. Do you hear that?
I have heard a lot of refugees coming from Syria to the northern part of Lebanon. I don't have an estimate of how many, but I do know they have been coming. Before the Syrian uprising, there was a lot of Syrian laborers. They were kind of considered the Mexicans, and I don't want to put it in a bad way, but they were the builders of construction. They built the apartment buildings and the condominiums, and they were there, and so they were there for economic reasons, just like how a lot of Mexican immigrants came here for economic reasons.
Sure.
And so there's been refugees for economic reasons, and now there's more for political unrest. And I don't know about Jordan. I'm assuming they might be in Jordan as well, but I don't know the figures. I do know Lebanon. And then on top of that, the civil unrest has, from what I was told last summer, as a result of the civil unrest in Syria, there's been less people coming to Beirut for vacation for the summer months. a lot of the Arabs that come from the Gulf to take the highway that goes through Syria from the Gulf, goes through Syria, and they have chalets or they have condos or they have some property in Lebanon that they like to stay in during the summer months. So it's the economy, the civil unrest has led to a slow economic downfall in Lebanon. So that's why
Let me go ahead and leave Tufik's essay because it actually we've got more than a half an hour of his excellent announcements as well. M.A., let me bring you on and have you talk about some of the other issues that haven't gotten so much coverage in the Arab Spring. You mentioned the reporter. We've all heard some stories about women who were badly treated. What else can you talk about in terms of what you see and what you hear in terms of the Arab Spring?
Well, the swing toward Islamism and the Arab Spring is deeply disturbing the liberal Arab women. I mean, they see in all the countries' elections from Tunisia to Egypt, the women are, you know, putting on side. And so far, Arab Spring has not yielded reforms that promote women's rights. In Egypt, women were not invited to join the committee preparing amendments to the constitution. You know about that. We talked about that before.
Sure.
In Tunisia, recently, actually, yesterday, there were some thousands of women, again, protesting on the streets. The Tunisia supposedly was supposed to be the most liberal Arab state before the uprising. Now the Islamists protested violently against the ban on enrollments of veiled women in college, which is very similar in Turkey too. If you're going to state colleges, you're not allowed to wear the veil or abaya or burqa, whatever else you call it. And also in Tunisia, Islamists were so against the film, and they called the film blasphemous. The film is called Persepolis. It's a wonderful film, and it was actually shown in 2008 in Tunisian Film Festival without any concerns. And now they call the film, they basically want to ban the film. It's about Iranian revolution, Islamic revolution, and what happened to women's rights there. So also in Libya, Libya's National Transition Committee proclaimed its goal to institute discriminatory religious laws, including polygamy. So the Islamist Justice and Development Party was recently elected. And a lot of things are happening that the Arab Spring is definitely not yielding the reforms that women expected.
I have a student in one of my classes who's an Egyptian gentleman, and he expressed quite a bit of concern about the status and the religious freedom in Egypt. He is of Coptic Christian extraction.
Yes, Coptics are not represented at all either. They're not.
And his concern early on, when most of us in the West were, you know, hearing only the positive buzz, he was concerned because he literally left there just as the outbreak occurred.
Mm-hmm.
And while there were some signs, and I think Dennis pointed to some signs of some positiveness and some toleration that was observed and practiced, what he was seeing as a person on the ground with family over there, that's not what his experience was. And he said he was very concerned. He also expressed a great deal of concern about Saudi fingerprints. And
yes,
he said he was hearing from his family that there were a lot of Saudi flags in Tahrir Square and in the Egyptian revolution, so-called. And so mm-hmm. that was his concern. And I was wondering, have you heard similar things?
I haven't heard about the Saudis, but it wouldn't surprise me. But what I know is 70% of the seats in the lower house of parliament won by the Islamist parties. And the upper house, they call it lower house and upper house in their system. Upper house, known as a Shura Council, they're called a Shura Council. I hope I'm pronouncing these right, but it's more like a consultative body, and
mm-hmm.
They weigh on the constitutional issues. Mubarak used the Shura Council to rubber stamp his administration's initiatives on that, but This time around, political analysts said that Islamists are widely expected to take control of the both councils, the council and the lower houses, 70%. So, I mean, we have to anticipate this a little bit because 85-90% of Egypt are Muslims. Mm-hmm. And 85% of the Egyptian population, really, they say that they don't really have a problem with Islamists being on the on their government. So I guess in a way we're going to have to accept that. But like Dennis Campbell said, democracy is very messy. It's not a straight line. It took us our Revolutionary War with English, British, and then after our Civil War here in the United States to really get our act together, and we're still working on it. So I believe it's going to take time for all these countries from Egypt to Tunisia to Syria, whatever is happening right now, it's on the ground right now, it's terrible. It's going to take time. It's not going to be an overnight, we just found democracy, you know. So hopefully, I mean, I know that the turnaround was remarkably low on the Sunday's election. People are just, the election process is very complicated in Egypt. They're just wary, voters, and they abstain from polls Sunday. So they're tired. It's a very complicated process. Maybe that should have been one of the first things that they needed to work on to kind of simplify the election process, but I guess we should still be happy that after 60 years, this is their first real election. So that's their country's people's will, and we're going to have to learn to work with it, I think.
Sure. Well, you know, I hope Mohammed calls us. He's scheduled to come in also for this discussion, but in case he doesn't, I'm not too worried because I plan a second evening on the Arab Spring, and because I've got more material from both Tufik and Dennis, and I do want to expand the conversation to try to get as many voices in as possible, because I completely understand that the truth is something that when seen from a variety of vantage points can look quite different. Mm-hmm. So I want to try to bring as many voices in as possible with as many perspectives as possible. So I'm going to ask you to think about maybe making a suggestion or inviting someone else to join us, and I would love to have you back again because I think this is an important issue. Too much American policy is wrapped up in here, if that's the only reason, not just general humanity. But I also think for humanity's purposes, there's been so much trouble and so much pain and so much hurt in the Middle East that I think if we can aid in the understanding a little bit of the issues at hand, I think that's very important to accomplish.
Well, of course, I mean, that's definitely, you know, these are affecting us directly. But I also believe the meddling of other countries, supplying of weapons, Russia, for example, is supplying a lot of weapons to Syrian troops. It's not helping the situation. I know that the United Nations, they estimate more than 5,400 people already being killed in Syria. And I know from Turkey's point of view, Turkey, Jordan, and United States, they were trying to get a resolution in United Nations to ask for Assad to step down. But Russia and China, they don't want to because Russia has a lot of contracts and selling weapons to the government. But interestingly enough, I found out that the rebel army, the Free Syrian Army that's fighting against the government, they're also armed with AK-47s and RPG-7s, which are Russian-made weapons. So, I mean, maybe if these people just, you know, leave the scene, people will, you know, solve their problems in their own way. That's not helping.
Yeah, unfortunately, I can imagine there are an awful lot of black market weapons floating around that whole area and all kinds of money with all kinds of agendas making that kind of traffic very, very easy. And unfortunately, this country has done more than its share of arming too many people. That's for sure.
And then it turns back to bite us in our butt, you know, eventually with Iraq, we know what happened with Saddam, and the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, originally Taliban. We gave them weapons against Russians when the Russian was invading the country.
Yeah, that's really worked out well, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Let me ask you one. On a final note, Emily, let me ask you, can you tell us some good news about something going on in the Middle East? Do you have you heard about some women's rights movement that's going well, or can you tell us some good news?
Good news? Well, the good news is at least people still didn't give up. So they're still going back. January 25th was the anniversary of their revolution, and there were thousands of people back on the Tahrir Square, a lot of women. So that's good news that they're not letting the military or the Islamist parties to take over their country. So they're still, I think the best news is people learned that they have the power to remove these dictators, these people. I mean, I was looking through from Tunisia to Libya. The Gaddafi was in the regime for almost 40 years. Ben Ali was their president from 1987 to 2011. And Saleh in Yemen, I mean, he was there from 1978 to 2012. So these people are just realizing that they have actually power to and they deserve freedom and democracy, and they have the power to bring these people down. So that's the good news to me.
Well, thanks, Emine. That's really good. That's a wonderful, good, important perception, and it is some good news we can take, that people have felt empowered, that people from Saudi Arabian women trying to do some driving to places throughout the Middle East, and of course in this country as well, people saying it's not enough to sit back and assume that people are going to do the right thing, that it's important for people to participate in government. That's what makes democracy work, when people participate in their government.
Exactly.
Well, thank you again, as always. It was tremendous having you on. You always bring tremendous resources to the show, and I hope you'll join us in 2 weeks when we have the second part of our Arab Spring show.
Sure, my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, we'll see you at that Susan B. Anthony dinner, I'm sure.
Sure, definitely.
Okay, and thanks, Emily. I want to also mention our good friends, the Amy Tidd Show. That's Saturday mornings from 10 a.m. to 11. And also There Be Monsters, produced by our good friend Gwen Holden Berry, another fantastic progressive broadcaster. And hopefully we'll be hearing from you, Emine, that your show is coming back on the air too. So
sure.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. We hope you enjoy this show tonight. We hope we can bring you some new insight, something much, much more than you'll get in the evening news. And I just can't thank you enough, Emine. And we'll be hearing more from Dennis and also Tufik as well. And we'll make sure that Mohammed logs in next time. Thanks a lot, and good night, everyone. Well, that old tape's not playing so good, is it? Let's try this little bit of Boogie Woogie here. I bring you a little Jungle Boogie, and I want to let you know that it's a better world's coming, because you and I are making sure that democracy works. Democracy has its own pace, and it works when you and I get involved and stay involved. That's what makes sure that we keep these civil servants' feet to the fire. That's the fire of democracy, the fire of human rights. So thank you all so much for joining us. We'll see you next when Progressive News Network brings you Representative Mark Pafford and also Representative Jeff Clemens, who will be talking about the latest adventures in the Florida legislature. So have a good night, and we'll talk to you next week.
They used to tell me I was building a dream, and so I followed them all. When there was earth to plow, guns to bear, I was always there, right on the job. They used to tell tell me I was building a dream with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in line just waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower up to the sun.